Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
And Bob Hill.
And today on the show, Bob and I agree that this is probably the best book that we have read on this subject ever.
Yes.
And it is a book called The Brother Gardeners by Andrea Wolfe. And it basically chronicles other people, too. But the main characters are a man named Collinson in England, John Bartram here in America, colonial America, Carl Linnaeus, Miller, who wrote, you know, who was at Chelsea,
dictionary.
Wrote a dictionary.
And The Mutiny on the Bounty.
Yeah. Joseph
All
Banks.
All connected somewhere.
David Solander. I had not heard of David Solander before.
I had not either.
Just a fabulous, fabulous book. Basically how the relationship between these men and how the whole plant exploration and sending, Bartram basically supplied England with all the plants they have today that fueled the garden craze in England, so we can sort of give a colonial American the credit for that, but then how it, you know, evolved through the rest of the 18th century.
What a great secret that is, that we supplied England with plants and trees and such that made it the garden island that it is.
No kidding.
To begin, anyway.
And, like, fueled that wanderlust of, I mean, we talk about it today.
Yeah.
Just the excitement of getting a plant that nobody else has. Can you imagine what it was like back then? It's not so easy like it is today.
Yeah, you can find it.
Yeah.
Go online.
Something exceptional, but really, really good book, The Brother Gardeners. And we're so excited to be able to talk to Andrea Wolfe later in the show, so stick around.
And mums.
And mums. And beyond mums.
Yeah, mums and beyond, yeah.
We've decided ever since the Knockout Rose that we were going beyond all of these things that everybody's familiar with. And sure, you know, the fall mum is pretty ubiquitous, should we say?
At least.
Fabulous plant, to be sure. But there are other types of mums out there as well. So we're going to talk to John Capobianco with the National Chrysanthemum Society. All right,
yep.
Bob?
Yep.
What's going on in your garden?
Well, speaking of new plants, I was up in Illinois and went to nurseries, three nice nurseries, mm-hmm. and bought some plants I'd never seen before, which I'm endlessly doing.
Crazy plant hunter
I know. But one of them is an aster that grows low, mm-hmm. only gets about 3 inches tall, mm-hmm. and creeps over rocks.
Cool.
And the Latin name, of course, I don't have because it's still in the pot. But I jumped right on that one. And I've tried Actinida before, the mm-hmm. kiwi vine, mm-hmm. and has a wonderful bicolor leaf if you grow it long enough. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to try that one more time.
Okay.
And I brought a bright red Asian lily. I mean, screaming red. So
good.
I can't wait to see that.
All of which were inspired by listening to Homegrown, perhaps?
Yeah. Well, no, I must have bought 30 plants I didn't have.
All right.
Now I
got
to find
great.
A place to put 30 plants I don't have room for.
That's right. Well, you might have to get rid of some.
No. Wish you stay. What's up?
Oh, I'm always late on my amaryllis, but that's okay. I never I always get my amaryllis to bloom again, but they never bloom at Christmas time. They're usually, you know, in February or March.
Right.
Because I should have pulled them out of, you know, where they got rain probably a month ago, and I just did it. But this is when you want your amaryllis bulbs to start to go dormant, so you don't want to water them or do anything. You can stick them somewhere in the basement in the dark. I usually stick them in the stairwell that goes from the garage down to the utility room in the basement. Mm-hmm. So it's totally dark there. They won't get any water. Come January or February, I check on them from time to time to see if they've started to send out their bloom spike.
Yeah. Yep.
But they have to have at least... I think at least a 10-week rest period, Bob.
I do, too.
So, no kidding. So, if you haven't done it so yet, it's not too late, because they'll bloom eventually, but go ahead and get those amaryllis ready to sort of die back and go dormant, okay?
Your confession, only more proof, we're not perfect either.
That's right.
We
but
try.
Hey,
yeah.
I'm quite happy having the blooms Valentine's Day instead of Christmas.
And I'm happy not being perfect.
Yeah, so am I.
Yeah,
no, well put.
Too much pressure.
No kidding.
Yeah.
So am I. All right. If you've got anything for our calendar, let us know. But we do need to know several weeks in advance. But you can go to our website at wfpl.org and send us that information for garden-related calendar items.
But what's blooming right now?
What is blooming right now? And that would be the chrysanthemum. The fall mum is everywhere, but there are more than just what you see in people's window boxes. John Capobianco is a member of the National Chrysanthemum Society, and he's joining us now. Apparently, there are 13 classifications, Bob, of chrysanthemums, and that's what engages the these enthusiasts around the world. Some of them cascade from baskets. Others are transformed into bonsai. How about that one?
I didn't know that.
So who knew the fall mom had so many other garden-worthy relatives? And John's here to talk about them today. John, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for the invitation.
Certainly. When you say mom, people likely do, in fact, think of just the fall mums that are scattered about everywhere across the country this time of the year. This is just one of the classifications of chrysanthemums. There are many more, and we kind of want to highlight those. But can you give us a little background on the history of the chrysanthemum in the U.S.? Because it came from somewhere else, didn't it?
Well, the history of the chrysanthemum is shrouded in antiquity. I mean, the flowers go all the way back to ancient China. And they were brought to the U.S. somewhere around the late 1880s, and they were called Japs. Yeah, a little derogatory, but that's what they were called. And they basically were imported from China and Japan.
So back then, did they have any particular use? I mean, that's kind of that Victorian era where the anything exotic appealed to people, yes?
That's definitely the case.
Uh-huh.
And that's when you start to see things like bonsai come into the country, bonsai being displayed at World's Fair. The chrysanthemums that we're used to are what we call garden hardies. Uh-huh. And the ones that were being brought in from China and Japan were exhibition varieties, or what later became known as football mums. Mm-hmm. They're the giants of the chrysanthemum family. Blooms are anywhere from 4 to 8 inches across, mm-hmm. sometimes up to 11 inches across.
So do you think it's fair to say that most people have no idea the range and beauty of these exhibition mums because they're really only familiar with the hardy mums?
Well, what has happened over the last 20, 30 years is due to changes in the economy and people's lifestyles, the appreciation for growing and showing and wearing these giant mums has waned. Mm-hmm. And part of the mission of the National Chrysanthemum Society is to preserve and promote the cultivation and exhibition of these mums.
Yeah, boy, because when I was back in high school in the 1700s, that's what you wore to football homecomings every year, these monster mums.
Yep, and that's how the term football mum came about.
Yeah, well, how did the fall mum become so ubiquitous then? What was the marketing campaign behind that?
Are you talking about the garden hardies or
yes.
the exhibition varieties?
Well, the garden hardies, the one you see everywhere in all the box stores and all the yards and so forth.
Chrysanthemums are amazing plants. They just want to live. You could take a piece of the plant, drop it on the ground. As long as it stays wet, it'll grow roots.
Mm-hmm.
So from the terms of being a cash crop, they're amazing. They're very easy to propagate, very little care, and growers today can go out and put down a bunch of weed cloth, line up a whole bunch of pots with an automatic drip system. They can bang out hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these pots with virtually no effort. And a lot of the new garden hardies have been cultivated so that they don't require a pinch.
Mm-hmm.
They don't need a little bit of tissue removed in order to create multiple branches.
Mm-hmm. John, that vigorous quality of the hardy mums, how does that translate to all these other, you know, exhibition mums that we'd like to hear about? Are they similarly?
Well, the exhibition mums are just as vigorous.
Okay.
If you don't train them properly, they'll grow to be 6-7 feet tall.
Okay.
What they don't have is the ability to withstand a really harsh winter. What we like to say about mums that they're greedy. They love food and they love water. They just don't like to sit in the water.
Mm-hmm.
So however you're going to grow them, whether it's in the ground or in a container, you have to have a free draining mix. They can't stand in water. And they will just grow as vigorously as you can. And if you want to, you treat them like dahlias. You dig up the root ball in the fall, store it in a relatively warm place over the winter. Next spring, you can make Dutch cuttings, or you can wait until the plants sprout out and make softwood cuttings, and you'll have a forest of them.
Hmm. We're in zone 6A, 6B here. Would the exhibition mum survive winter share with mulch?
Dicey. I'm zone 7A, 7B up here,
okay.
And I have a difficult time wintering them over. Some of the exhibition varieties seem to be much sturdier than others, and they have wintered through.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them, they just can't handle it.
So, John, there's 13 different classifications, one of which is like a non-classification, according to what I looked at.
Chrysanthemums are broken down into 13 different bloom categories based on the arrangement of their florets. What people don't understand is that a chrysanthemum flower is not one flower. It's dozens or hundreds of florets, mini flowers. Each one of those petals that you see on the bloom is capable of producing a seed.
Oh.
And depending on how the two types of flowers, there are ray florets,
mm-hmm.
and there are disc florets. The florets are in the center. The rays ring around the outside. And depending on how those are arranged, we have 13 different designations for them.
Okay. So with names
those,
like...
Those are our bloom categories.
Okay. And just to kind of give our listeners a vision in their head, the classifications have names like incurve, reflex, pom-pom, single...
It's pom-pon. Most people get that wrong. It's P-O-M-P-O-N.
Okay. Pom-pon. Spoon, spider, thistle, that sort of thing. So... It basically describes sort of the quality of that bloom. One of the moms that I think in this category that I'm familiar with are those that you can get when you go buy cut flowers.
You will see what we call, what a lot of people call florist moms, are really exhibition moms that have been grown in quantity under very controlled conditions.
Okay.
The chrysanthemum is a fall flower because it reacts to the length of day. The shorter the days get, the plant knows that it's time to go into what's called sexual reproduction mode. Okay. It needs to set its flower buds, and it needs to get ready to produce the next generation. So because of that, you can manipulate the bloom time and have chrysanthemums all year long. And those big ones are the ones you'll see in floral arrangements.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, John, we're all familiar with bonsai and conifers and in other small deciduous trees. I've never seen, to my knowledge, a bonsai mum. Tell us about those.
You're right. Bonsai is a Japanese art that has its origins in ancient China. And basically, the characters for the word mean small tree.
Mm-hmm.
And the definition that I work with for bonsai is any plant that can be containerized, develops a woody trunk, and can be trained so that it looks like a small tree. So you can take certain cultivars of chrysanthemums. They've been bred to have limber stems, very small flowers, good surface root, and you can train them in all the traditional and a couple untraditional bonsai styles. So you can make them look like spruce trees, you can make them look like maple trees, you can make them look like oak trees, whatever your fancy is, you can style them and design them.
Can you tell us what your setup at home is in your garden? And I suspect you grow some of them outside and then bring some of them inside, but it sounds like if you wanted to be exotic chrysanthemum grower, you would be well suited to have a greenhouse or somewhere where you could keep them thriving during the winter.
That depends on whether you want to enter sanctioned competition.
Okay.
The National Chrysanthemum Society has a series of rules, and one of the rules is that your mums must be grown outdoors.
Hmm.
So at home, basically, I have a 10-foot by 2.5-foot bed. That bed gets amended every year with organic material. And I either propagate my own cuttings or I purchase from one of the suppliers, and there are fewer and fewer of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I line out the bed with the cuttings, and then I put a PVC frame around it. And for the blooms that want to open around Thanksgiving time, if I need them for a show in October, I trick the plant into thinking fall came early. And I do that by placing either a black polypropylene tarp or a black plastic over the plant for a minimum of 12 hours a night, commencing 10, 11, or 12 weeks before I want the plant to be in bloom.
Okay. So when winter comes, you let the plants die, you take cuttings, do you know what I mean? Is it just, do you consider it an annual plant for the most part?
No, they are perennials.
Okay.
Just some of them are what we would call tender perennials.
Okay, but some of them
like,
will be hardy.
Kind of like dahlias.
Uh-huh.
Where that you have to protect the root ball some way.
Okay.
So I have a cold frame, and I keep that cold frame between 28 and 50, 55 degrees in the winter, and I'm able to dig up my root balls and store them for the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, you get, 80, 90% of them to come through the winter for you.
Okay.
Well, John, most of us in the fall just go out and buy mums by color at box stores, but for Zone 6, can you maybe list 4 or 5 or 6 plants you think that might be a little different that we could grow here if we just searched a little bit to find them?
Chrysanthemums or other species?
Your exotic chrysanthemums.
Yeah, the more exotic ones.
You're not going to find them.
Okay.
The only place you're going to find them is in a florist shop. And if you wanted to try and propagate from them, you could.
Mm-hmm.
There are several companies around the country, most notably King's Mums in Oregon.
Right, I looked at that.
Which will sell you individual cuttings of an individual variety.
Mm-hmm.
There are other companies like Ball and I think it's Yoder Brother, might be Glockner. I think they were bought by Glockner now. They will sell you cultivars, but you have to buy in blocks of 50.
Mm-hmm.
So unless you and your neighbors are going to get together and do a mum festival, mm-hmm. You're better off going to one of these retailers or join one of the chrysanthemum groups on Yahoo, and you can trade cuttings with other growers around the country. You're going to be very hard-pressed to find these exhibition variety mums on roots where you could put them in the ground this time of year. The time to purchase them is between April and June in order to have flowers for the fall, assuming, you know, you don't have a million-dollar greenhouse that's mechanized with, you know, 12-hour lighting cycles.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now we'll list the National Chrysanthemum Society on our website, but talk some about that and maybe how people can go there and find these plants.
Well, the National Chrysanthemum Society is a not-for-profit organization, and we will be celebrating our 66th show and convention this October at the Asheville Arboretum in Asheville, North Carolina. Our website is mums.org, and we have chapters all around the country, and these chapters promote and preserve chrysanthemum culture by offering classes and lectures and workshops. So the NCS is an excellent resource for anyone who wants to get involved in all things mums.
All right, John, thank Absolutely. You so much. We appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, Janine. Thank you, Bob.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
John Capobianco is a member and officer of the National Chrysanthemum Society. He spoke to us from his home in Farmington, New York. For more information, please see our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, Andrea Wolf and the Brother Gardeners. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill on the other end.
On the other end. And you know what? I want to say we are so lucky because so many of the books that we read, we love. But I guess that's why we actually interview the people. Like, the ones that we don't like, we don't.
Exactly.
But this book, The Brother Gardeners, was so fascinating. So whether you're interested in horticulture or just history,
yeah.
It's that whole like putting things into context and the interrelationship between people and events that make something happen. You know, it doesn't happen in a vacuum, but it happens over a century or several decades, and it's right here in this book.
It's the best book I've ever read on the subject.
Yeah, really absolutely.
Is.
Me
yeah.
too.
And happily, we've got the author with us. Andrea Wolf was trained as a design historian at the Royal College of Art and has written for the Sunday Times, The Garden, and Architect's Journal. Her previous book, The Other Eden, was a history of England as told through seven gardens. She's with us today from her home in London to talk about her newest book, The Brother Gardeners. Andrea, welcome to Homegrown.
Hello.
And you come to this book through kind of a fascinating background in design history, and you use that history in, like in a previous book where you wrote about the history of England through seven gardens. So first, tell our listeners about that background and how it lends itself to writing books about history and gardens.
Well, I think so. Bear in mind, I'm not a plant person, actually. I studied design history. So what I'm interested in is really to kind of look at objects that men and women use and kind of use those almost as a window into another time to kind of learn about a different kind of a past society, about technology, about science or politics from the past. So gardens, in a way, I think kind of lend themselves really beautifully, much more so than houses, because they, you know, they continue to grow. You know, people have very much a kind of emotional relationship to planting. For example, if you plant an oak tree, you know that you're never going to see that growing to maturity. So it's this kind of belief in the future. It's a belief in your family. It's a belief in your nation, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've always been really fascinated by kind of gardens as a, you know, vehicle to look at other things within a society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I thought it was in your introduction kind of funny when you moved to England how you weren't really into gardening, but everybody else was. So there had to be something there, and that kind of sparked
it. It was really extraordinary to kind of because I'm from Germany,
uh-huh.
And obviously there are some kind of great gardeners in Germany. I don't want to, you know, offend anybody, but it was just so different here, and I just had the feeling everybody, young and old, is really obsessed with gardening, mm-hmm. and for me it was almost a way to understand the British, I suppose, you know, that as a foreigner, to understand why is everybody sure. so crazy about gardening, why, you know, everybody young and old seems to think like a day digging in the flower bed is yeah. the greatest entertainment, when all my German friends, to the day, I have to say, still think it's completely mad that I'm writing about gardens.
You got to find the context somehow. And the context goes back to the early 18th century. Bob and I had discussed how fascinating it was because we never really thought about how colonial America played such a huge role in the way that really the England, to be sure, Britain, Great Britain, but almost the rest of the world really started to garden.
Yeah, I think I was really surprised about that too. Is this because I kind of set out to understand why the British were so obsessed or are so obsessed with gardens. And what I found was this kind of story of a garden revolution in the 18th century, which really had started in America. And so many gardeners, you know, across the world see England, you know, basically as the motherland of horticulture. And, you know, what is not to love about the rolling parkland and a kind of thatched cottage kind of covered with rambling roses and glorious herbaceous borders. But what we kind of don't realize is that a lot of this has a root in America, because in the early 18th century, the English garden was not very colorful, for example, and it was only through the influx of American plants in the 18th century, huge influx, that the English gardener could enjoy autumn colors.
Mm-hmm.
There are only four native British evergreens, for example. So a lot of the evergreens here are actually from America.
Yeah, and of course, there's a lot of fascinating characters in your book, but one I didn't realize, a man named Thomas Fairchild, who developed the world's first man-made hybrid, then was afraid to talk about it.
Yeah, Thomas Fairchild is almost, I mean, I have him in my prologue because he's really the beginning of the story, how man kind of dares to look at nature in a different way. And he, in 1716, he kind of locks himself into his potting shed. He's a nurseryman in London. And he puts the pollen from a carnation onto Sweet William and creates the first man-made hybrid. And then when he later grows that hybrid, he's the gardener inside him is delighted because he's created a new plant. And, mm-hmm. You know, until then, he always had to wait for a plant explorer to go to another country to kind of give him a new plant. But at the same time, he completely panics because he feels he's kind of meddled with God's creation.
Right.
And he actually leaves a legacy for his parish church for an annual sermon, which is called the Vegetable Sermon, on God's creation, which, believe it or not, how eccentric are the English, is still held every year here in London.
So can you sort of set the stage, you know, after Fairchild's mule, as it was called, set the stage for the other six players in the book? There are six specific people that you talk about that, you know, pretty much you refer to the brother gardeners that kind of changed the face of everything. Give us a snapshot of what's happening around the world, really, at that time, particularly America.
So the story really begins with two men, which are Peter Collinson and John Bartram. Peter Collinson is a Quaker merchant in London, a kind of fanatic plant collector, and John Bartram is an American farmer who lives just outside Philadelphia. And at that time, Collinson is kind of doing a lot of business with the North American colonies, so he gets Bartram to collect these plants, put them on boats, send them to England. Mm-hmm. Then you have a man called Philip Miller, who is the head gardener of the Chelsea Physic Garden here in London, who turns the Chelsea Physic Garden into one of the greatest botanic collections in the world. But most importantly, he writes a book, which is called The Gardener's Dictionary, which is really, I would say, the mother of all plant dictionaries. So if you think of a plant dictionary today, it's, you know, alphabetically kind of sorted. You know, each entry is a species of plant. You can look it up. You can see how the plant is cultivated. It seems pretty normal to us, but it was absolutely revolutionary in the early 18th century when he published that, because until then, horticultural publications had really kind of just repeated plant myth and superstition. Mm-hmm. So nothing was really based on scientific observation, and that's what Philip Miller does with his dictionary. He observes what he does in the Chelsea Physic Garden, and he gives this professional knowledge to the amateur gardener.
Okay, that's
and
what I think that, gonna ask.
That's a kind of important point if you want to, you know, set the scene for these men. So you have before they start acting. Gardening is really very much, you know, you have big aristocratic landowners who have professional gardeners, and then a lot of other gardening is still very much based on superstition. So, for example, these plant books advise things like you should graft lemons onto mulberry trees to turn them red. kind of things like, oh, you should plant, if you want to have double roses, you should plant the seeds during full moon.
Right.
So these men kind of really make use of the scientific revolution and apply it to gardening. And then you have the next kind of important person in the book is Carl Linnaeus, who's a Swedish botanist, and he sits down and kind of classifies the plant world into something very simple and obvious, which everybody can learn. But he also gives us the Latin plant names, which we still use today, which is a standardized plant name, which I think we all take for granted. That I can, you know, I can go to a nursery in my parents' hometown in Germany, or here in London, or in Washington, and I can buy exactly the same plant because each plant has a Latin name, a two-word name, which is almost like the first name and the second name.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of an extraordinary moment in gardening, because these gardeners across the world can now talk with sense about plants. So John Bartram in America can say, I'm sending you Magnolia grandiflora, and Collinson knows exactly what he's talking about. And then you have Daniel Solander, who's also Swedish, who's a pupil of Linnaeus, who comes to England and then goes together with Joseph Banks, who's also a protagonist in the book, and they go with Captain Cook on the Endeavour and circumnavigate the globe and collect plants, for example, from Australia. And this is a moment, this is, you know, after the War of Independence, other parts of the world become more important for England because they don't have that kind of easy access anymore.
Other places.
Andrea, I want to back up a little bit and talk more about John Bartram, his relationship with Peter Collinson, because it was such a unique situation. Talk about his explorations around the country. I knew John Bartram vaguely, but had no idea the extent and the place he played in plant history.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, John Bartram, of all of them, is my absolute favorite. He's just such a wonderful, charming, delightful man. He's so he lives just outside Philadelphia, and you can actually still go and see his garden. It's, like, wonderfully restored. He's a Quaker, and he's a passionate botanist, but he has to mainly kind of farm because that's how he makes his money. But through Benjamin Franklin, he gets introduced to Peter Collinson, and they set up this system whereby English gardeners can pay 5 guineas per seed box, and for that they get a box of seeds, 105 different varieties each year from America. And to collect the seeds, Bartram has to go every autumn on his plant hunting trips, which start off in the beginning just around, you know, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, New Jersey. Then he goes down to Virginia, and his kind of journeys become longer and longer, and by at the end of his life he goes down all the way down to Florida. So he spends often weeks and weeks completely on his own in the wilderness collecting the seeds and writing absolutely beautiful, charming letters to Collinson, so that Collinson, from the comfort of his armchair in London, can follow him step by step. Also, you know, sometimes giving him advice, which kind of seems a bit weird if you think, you know, that man has basically never left England. He's giving him advice how to kind of deal with Native Americans, or with, he gets really, Collinson, for example, gets really upset that Bartram only ever encounters rattlesnakes, when, you know, it would be much more exciting if there was some panthers or bears.
Well, that's part of why this book is so good, because you reveal to us the dynamics, the true dynamics of the relationships between these men. And, you know, there's a lot of ego involved. There's a lot of realizing that you'll only achieve what you want to achieve if you sort of kowtow to this person. And it makes it real, you know.
Well, I think, you know, I've always been fascinated by the human stories behind all this, because I think they tell you the most, and the letters in a way tell you more than anything else, because you can actually, you know, they talk with their own voices to me or to the reader. And over the 40 years of the friendship between Collinson and Bartram, there's this enormous shift from a very unequal relationship in the beginning, where Collinson clearly sees himself as far superior to this humble farmer. And by the end of the friendship, Bartram is corresponding with all the important scientists, botanical scientists in Europe. He's directly corresponding with Linnaeus, for example. And Collinson has really learned to accept him as an equal. And they become, over the time, they become like this wonderful bickering couple who have these, you know, petty arguments, which can take years, because it takes months and months for the letters to cross the Atlantic. So, you know, Collinson complains about something. 5 months later, Bartram gets the letter and goes like, what? You can't say that. Writes the letter back. Oh. Takes another 5 months. And it just goes backwards and forwards. And it's just, I think, a kind of really revealing relationship of friendship, but also competition, which I think gardening is quite competitive. You know, at least in England, there are a lot of people who look over the garden fence to their neighbor and are delighted when they see that something goes wrong.
And in the meantime, Bartram's shipping back tens of thousands of plants and trees to England and later, and beyond, even to the continent after that, I guess.
Yes, you know, there had been, before Bartram, there have been other collectors who have sent plants from America, but these are minute quantities for, you know, botanic collections. So you would have like one tulip poplar in a botanic collection. And what Bartram does, what really changes and completely transforms the English landscape, is that he showers acorn seeds and cones onto the English landscape, because he's sending thousands of seeds. So, for example, he sends to one of his first customers, he sends one box with 1,500 cones of tulip tree seeds. So, there, you know, it's huge amounts which are crossing the Atlantic. And many of them kind of fail, obviously. But within a few decades, the English landscape has changed. And Bartram is basically furnishing the Georgian shrubbery, or, you know, all the flowering shrubs like rhododendron, kalmias, they come from America. Flowering trees like the southern catalpa or the Magnolia grandiflora all comes from America, and the English go completely crazy, because suddenly they have these beautiful trees and shrubs which give them beauty in the garden all year round, rather than only for 5 or 6 months.
Now, were modern-day Englishmen as surprised about this as we were, or too much ego to admit that John Bartram actually greened up their country for them?
Yeah, I think you could say that.
Okay. Nobody tried to, like, silence you, I hope. Talk about some hardcore egos. I think Collinson and Bartram were rather agreeable, but Miller and Linnaeus were a little more egotistic, I think.
Well, I think Linnaeus is particularly like the best of the bunch in terms of being selfish and a little bit arrogant. He was really cantankerous. And he called himself rather modestly Prince of Botanists. So, you know, he has a quite, I would say, healthy self-confidence. Kind of rightly so, because he is really a genius botanist, and he is an absolute genius classifier of plants. But in kind of personalities, he's a little bit unpleasant, and people get upset with him, because sometimes he doesn't really want to share things, and he's
arrogant.
He's kind. He's just not very, very nice. But he, like, in terms of botany, he did an amazing job. But for example, Solander, who is his pupil, was trained up by Linnaeus to become his successor in the botanic garden in Uppsala in Sweden. And Solander arrives in England just for a year, and then decides to stay because it's just so much nicer, I think, for him to be away from Linnaeus, who's he's a complete control freak, basically. And he, for example, he decides what his pupils have to wear when they go on botanical excursions.
Right.
You know, they have to wear this kind of botanical linen uniform.
Mm-hmm.
So he is not a pleasant person, but I think he's very funny. His letters are very funny because he takes himself so incredibly serious.
Mm-hmm. Andrea, initially when he first went to England and London, Linnaeus, he really went there to woo the English because he felt as though his new system of naming plants, I think people would be surprised at this as well, he was met with great resistance. And
yes.
I think mostly it's the egotism that, no, the way we're doing it now is fine. But Philip Miller, if he couldn't get certain people in his camp, so to speak, he felt like, you know, it was just going to be more of a challenge to get it across. And most people really kind of turned their back on him.
Yeah, so the Gardener's, Philip Miller's Gardener's Dictionary was such a bestseller. It went through 8 editions during his lifetime, and it was published in Dutch, in the Netherlands, and in Germany, and later in France. So to get Miller on board, if Miller had used, which he actually in the last edition he did, but in the beginning he didn't, if Miller had used Linnaeus' system, it would have been accepted probably throughout Europe by gardeners and botanists. But Miller absolutely refused to do that. So that was a great kind of point of disappointment for Linnaeus. The problem with his system was that his classification system was called the sexual system, because what he did is he divided the world of flowering plants into 23 classes according to the number of stamens, the male organs of a plant, which he called the husbands. And he then further subdivided this by the number of pistils, which are the female organs,
the
which he calls wives. So the English were absolutely terrified by the indecency of the system. And one botanist actually said it's too smutty for British ears. So they just didn't like this at all.
And your book sails on through Daniel Solander and, of course, the epic Voyage of the Endeavor with Joseph Banks and Captain James Cook, all names out of history. So talk about the Endeavor and what they did.
Well, I think the Endeavor is really the most daring voyage that the English planned in the 18th century. You know, and imagine you have Joseph Banks, who is one of the wealthiest landowners in England, who can live a very comfortable life as, you know, a country gentleman, but he is a obsessive botanist. And what does he do? He exchanges his comfortable, luxurious life with a windowless cabin on the Endeavour, which is literally the size of a shoebox, and risks his life. You know, they're going across the whole globe. They arrive at the east coast of Australia, where no white man had ever been. They see plants they've never seen, and he does it all for plants. He pays for his own passage. He pays £10,000 for it, which is more than his annual income, and he's one of the wealthiest men in England. So it's a lot of money he's spending. And what the journey of the Voyage of the Endeavour does is it unlocks the globe, the kind of horticultural treasure of the globe for the English. Because although Banks didn't actually bring a lot of living plants back, because he's just far too long on a boat, he brings back 30,000 pressed specimens, of which 1,400 species are completely new to English botanists, which is a vast amount if you think that they only knew 6,000 species.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, suddenly there's like another fifth more. And because he then becomes the president of the Royal Society here and the nominal director of Kew Gardens, which is also a big botanic garden here, he is an advisor to King George III. So he's in a very unique position to send out plant collectors. But unlike other wealthy people who send off plant collectors, he can actually show them his dried specimens. And it almost works like a mail order catalog, where he can say, like, see, this is what I found there. I want you to bring those seeds back, those and those and those. And he can judge exactly the climate, the soil, everything about these plants. So and because he's a great believer that plants bring economic profit to a country, he starts this whole thing of, you know, bringing useful plants, say, from India to Kew, testing them there, sending them out somewhere else to, you know, use plants almost like the fuel to the engine of the, what the empire is. And I think that's where he's very different, say, to Bartram and Collinson, who really collect for ornamental.
One thing, let's talk about just the realities of what they're doing on those ships, though, Andrea. Bob and I were laughing. We had no idea that the mutiny on the Bounty, all those movies that I have seen about the mutiny on the Bounty, nobody ever mentioned the fact that, you know, the whole expedition was to collect plants. Talk about the Bounty.
Yeah, I had never really clicked about that. Uh-huh. And whenever I give a talk, people go and say, like, what?
Yeah.
because we've all heard so much about the Bounty. So basically what happens, Joseph Banks has this, you know, when he went on the Endeavour, he went to the East Indies and he saw on Tahiti how they basically lived off breadfruit trees, or the breadfruit from the breadfruit trees, which is a huge fruit which can be baked, and it becomes almost like a loaf of bread. That's why it's called breadfruit trees. So he thinks, that would be really good for the slave plantations in the West Indies.
Mm-hmm.
So he sends Captain William Bligh out to pick up 1,500 breadfruit trees and then to ship them to the West Indies. And what Banks actually does is he equips the Bounty as a floating garden. So Bligh has to give up the great cabin, which normally is like, you know, the kind of symbol of the authority of a captain, and it becomes a greenhouse. They put in skylights, they put in false floors, so that with little holes where in each hole you have one pot for the plant. Only cargo on that boat is the water they will need to water the plants.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, then you have the mutiny on the Bounty, and they kind of sail off with the breadfruit trees on the boat and kind of cast Bligh and a few members of the crew in an open ship, and he kind of gets, you know, makes his way back to England. Extraordinary that he manages. Mm-hmm. And then Banks sends him again 2 years later, and that time it actually works out.
Okay.
And the breadfruit tree is now a naturalized tree in the West Indies.
Huh.
Remarkable. Amazing. Thank you. Fascinating.
It was so good. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Andrea Wolfe is author of The Brother Gardeners, a book about six men who changed horticulture forever. For more information on the book or Andrea, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and another chapter in Bob's Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
With two more questions.
Two more questions. You want to start?
Yes, ma'am. This is from Bethany. Dear Bob and Janine, I'm starting a part-shade perennial garden in my side yard. I have decided on native plants that I would like to include and have created a garden design. My problem is finding out when each plant should be planted, fall or spring, whether to plant from seed or established plants. I prefer seeds. They'd be cheaper, but established plants would probably be easier. Do you know of any resources figuring out when to start my plantings? I think Bob and Janine are pretty good resources on this one.
Most of what she would probably include in her design, I wish she would have kind of given us some ideas in terms of what the plants were, are probably going to be best started as,
right,
you know,
as plants.
As plants.
It's hard to plant seeds now or start seeds now and have any luck.
Yeah.
It's too late.
She could try to do some indoor seed starting, you know, after Christmas and see what happens. But basically, when you buy your, if you buy seed, it'll tell you on the seed packet if it should be, you know, sown outdoors. And there are some plants that do better, but most of the ones that are better sown outside are annuals, not perennials.
It's a little late in the game for seeds.
That's fair to say, don't you think? Most perennials, you're going to be better off taking a root cutting, making some sort of cutting, or, you know, just buying the plant. So, and it's too bad, Bethany, because back in September, I remember one calendar week, there were like plant sales everywhere. And that would have been a good opportunity for you to stock up on some interesting plants. Also to talk with other gardeners, you know, that know what they're doing
right.
to exchange plants. But a lot of the garden centers have a lot of their items still on sale. So you can get some good deals this time of the year. And you can absolutely still plant most of these herbaceous perennials in the fall. I prefer it, in fact.
I do too. Yeah.
Because then your plants are really ready to go come right. springtime. So shop the sales. Get some plants, go ahead and get them in the ground, and then in the spring you can plant some more. I mean, it's just basically an accumulation, don't you think?
Exactly.
Here's another question from Dennis Bob. Hi, Janine and Bob. Let's see. In 1993, I planted a pair of plum trees. One was a Stanley. Forgot what the other one was.
Steamer.
Sounds like us.
Stanley Steamer.
They seem healthy. They're about 5 inches in diameter. Every year they both flower like crazy. The Stanley sets lots of fruit, way too much fruit, in fact. But once they reach a quarter inch, the fruit usually drops off. Few hang on, but usually they fall off long before they ripen. What could be wrong?
I actually went online for this one because I wasn't sure myself, and there's four pretty good reasons. One is it's too heavy a load, and the tree knows that. It'll mm-hmm. drop some itself. Excess wind will blow some off. A drought followed by heavy rain will cause drop, as well as a cold after warm.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those things have happened.
Which cold after warm usually happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of those things have happened this year. So any one of those four could be it, or maybe even insects.
Yeah. Because plums, I mean, fruit trees in general, all kinds of fungal diseases. And this year in particular, because it was so cool and wet, lots of fungal diseases. There's a thing called black knot. If you see like lesions or knotty spots on the tree,
right.
that can cause problems. The lights are flickering in the studio. I wonder if we're about to lose electricity.
The gods are angry with us now.
That could cause some problems. And I would say the number one thing you might want to do, Bob, wouldn't you, is prune that tree properly well, if you've never done so. And from now on, as soon as little teeny tiny things of fruit start to set,
yep.
you need to thin that tree dramatically. Nature
right.
doesn't always do it. You need to get in there and thin that tree, and then maybe your chances of holding on to your fruit, as Bob said, will increase. But that's what I'd do. University of Kentucky's Department of Horticulture, their website on home fruit production is the most extensive information. So I would look into that for all the details for pruning and disease management.
I'll get a peach of a plum out of it.
There you go.
If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Call us at 814-8246.
Bob, it's a plant story day. What do you have for us?
I'll bet you have it.
I hope. Well, I'll find out.
Helenium.
Helenium?
Yeah. Also called a sneezeweed.
I don't know if I do, actually.
Come on.
Yeah.
I finally stumped you.
Huh. Well, I mean, I know what it is, but I don't think I have it.
It's a great plant.
Yeah.
It's called a sneezeweed because it blooms at the same time as the ragweed.
Like now.
It's totally unfair.
Yeah.
It's got nothing to do with your sneezing. It's one of the three H plants that bloom in the fall. There's the helianthus,
uh-huh.
the heliopsis,
uh-huh.
and helenium.
Hello.
All three kind of cool.
Sounds good.
It's way underused. I came across two. I was on a recent trip to New Jersey or Northern Illinois, and I saw two cultivars of it. It's Morheim Beauty and Crimson Beauty. Bronze, copper red, crimson red. It's got kind of a daisy-like flower. It gets 18 to 36 inches tall, but a beautiful plant because it's tough and hardy. And the most common around here is the Helenium autumnale,
mm-hmm.
meaning it blooms in.
Autumn.
Thank you very much. And mahogany, red, orange, gold, red and yellow, all kinds of things and colors. Loves full sun. Might take some staking once in a while. It's a native to North America mm-hmm. and was first sent back to England in the 1700s.
Go figure.
Speaking of the rest of the show, yeah.
That's right.
The name derivation is interesting. It's either from the tears from the Helen of Troy.
Okay.
Named after Helena, a Greek woman who was stolen away while her hands were full of flowers.
Huh.
Named for the island.
That happens
of,
to me all the time.
Named for the island of Helena, or most likely, as with Heliopsis and Helianthus, came from the Greek word helios, meaning sun.
Sun.
I thought you'd know that.
My middle name is Helen, see?
There you go. Well, you're a sunny disposition most of the time. And the name sneezeweed may have come because of the use of dried flowers as snuff by the early settlers. It's also used as a medicinal way, and they all are,
sure.
Before Eli Lilly, as for deafness, rheumatism, congestion. But it comes with a poem.
All right.
Every late summer, with autumn still to come, It's Heliopsis, Helianthus, and Helenium. All three sun-loving plants with much to adore. Praise be to the Greeks, they didn't name four. But today we will focus on the least known of the breed, the unfortunately named autumn sneezeweed. A vigorous plant with colors quite bold, mahogany, orange, yellow, and gold. Yet a plant often missing from the gardener's plate, done in by a name that's so hard to take. For when the allergies come, as in the Ohio Valley they do, who will ever buy a plant that could end with achoo?
No kidding. So I need sneezeweed for my garden, and you need those exotic chrysanthemums in yours.
It really is.
And we will have continued on with the quest for finding interesting
plants.
That's
what I'm doing.
All right. Thank you, Bob. That ends another edition of Homegrown. We do indeed hope you join us next week for another show.
Homegrown is produced by the never-sneezing Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.